It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. We will talk about TLS Anvil, a really interesting testing framework for TLS libraries. Works really well. Google is delaying, who could have predicted it? Once again, the removal of third-party cookies from Chrome. And proof positive that turning off macros in Microsoft Office really works. Plus, a look at Rowhammer. It's back again. The attack that just never quits. It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 882, recorded Tuesday, August 2nd, 2022. Rowhammer's Nine Lives. Security Now is brought to you by Tanium. Tanium unites operations and security teams with a single platform that identifies where all your IT data is, patches every device you own in seconds, and implements critical security controls, all from a single pane of glass. Are you ready to protect your organization from cyber threats? Learn more at tanium.com/twit. And by IT Pro TV. Are you looking to break into the world of IT? Get the introduction you need with IT Pro TV. Visit itpro.tv/securitynow for an additional 30% off all consumer subscriptions for the lifetime of your active subscription when you use the code SN30 at checkout. And by Grammarly. Get through those emails and your work quicker by keeping it concise, confident, and effective with Grammarly. Go to grammarly.com/security now to sign up for a free account. And when you're ready to upgrade to Grammarly Premium, you'll get 20% off. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover your security, privacy, online with this guy right here. And all that jazz. Mr. Steve Gibson. Hello, Steve.
Yo, Leo. Great to be with you. We're episode 882. The next one of note will be in 6 weeks. It'll be 888. So, you know, just because that's a fun number. But that'll, you know, here we're in August already.
Already in August.
Man. Okay, so this is not the actual name of the exploit. The name of the exploit didn't really move me much. It was called Half Double. But what it is...
Half Double is a single.
Yeah, exactly. But it is brilliant. And so I just thought it would be too fun not to share it with our listeners. So today's title is Rowhammer's Nine Lives.
Oh, man.
Because, yes, it isn't gone yet, and these guys have figured out a way to still flip bits in DRAM and exploit it. In fact, I don't mention this until the very end, but on a brand new, completely up-to-date Chromebook, an unprivileged user can obtain root, that kernel access, in 45 minutes.
Oh, on a Chromebook?
On a Chromebook. So, of course, this has all of the cloud people terrified because they're all sharing hardware, assuming that you've got protection against a random virtual server in the cloud obtaining root on its host. And this makes it possible. Anyway, we're going to have fun talking about that. But we're going to first note an urgent vulnerability created by an add-on to Atlassian's Confluence corporate work group server. Next week's Usenix security conference will be presenting not only the subject of the show, this new Rowhammer attack, but also something very cool called TLS Anvil, which is used for testing TLS libraries. And 13 of them were tested. We'll talk about what it found, and it's like it's not nothing. Google has decided again, although I'm on their side on this. Well, I'm at least on their side on the initiative. They've decided to again delay their removal of third-party cookies from Chrome, and for, you know, presumably good reasons. We'll talk about that. And it turns out that attackers were already switching away from using Office macros before Microsoft actually did it. We'll talk about the backstory there. We also have a bunch of listener feedback, some thoughts about computer science theory and bit lengths that I thought our listeners would also find interesting, some interesting miscellany, and then we're going to look at the return of Rowhammer, which we never really seem to get rid of, thanks to some really just awesome, brilliant, and clever research. And, of course, I would argue that this is one of our better pictures of the week. We've had
people are howling over this.
some that are really fun. I gave it the title. It didn't come with a title, but I like the title. Anyway, it's a great one. So I think another overall great podcast.
It'll be a lot of fun,
listeners.
We'll get to the picture of the week in moments, but first a word from Tanium. One of those names you probably have heard many times, kind of an upstart in the security business that's really transforming how people think about security. Tanium's position is that the current approach, the general approach to cybersecurity, is kind of fundamentally flawed. IT management and security point tools offer a small piece of the solution needed to protect your environment, and many of them promise they can stop all breaches, and, well, we just know they can't. Plus, and this is maybe even a bigger but more subtle problem, it's hard to make proper decisions about security when you don't have up-to-date data. And trying to defend your critical assets from cyber attacks with tools that don't talk to each other is just, well, that's just a bad idea. No way for IT teams to navigate today's complex, fast-moving attack surface. So Tanium has a different approach. Their idea is a convergence of tools, endpoints, IT operations, and security that can give you up-to-date data so you know exactly what's going on and give you solutions that can solve problems fast. Solutions for government entities, education, financial services, retail, healthcare. Trust Tanium for every workflow that relies on endpoint data, which is, you know, pretty much everybody, right? With Tanium, all in one, you can do asset discovery and inventory, which means you can, you know, track down every IT asset you own instantaneously. You can do risk and compliance management, find and fix vulnerabilities at scale in seconds. I mean, imagine patching everything you've got in seconds. Threat hunting for sophisticated adversaries in real time. So you get client management, which automates operations from discovery to management. You get sensitive data monitoring, which indexes and monitors sensitive data globally in seconds. Tanium is here to really protect your organization where other endpoint management and security providers have failed. One platform, that's key. Single pane of glass. Tanium identifies where all your data is across your entire estate, patches every device you own in seconds, implements critical security controls, and it can do it all, you know, right there with a single pane of glass. Ask Kevin Bush. He's vice president of IT at Ring Power Corp. Here's the quote. Kevin says, quote, Tanium brings visibility to one screen for our whole team. And if you don't have that kind of visibility, you're not going to be able to sleep at night. Kevin sounds like that's oddly specific. Sounds like he knows. With real-time data comes real-time impact. If you're ready to unite operations and security teams with a single source of truth and confidently protect your organization from cyber threats, well, maybe it's time you met Tanium. You can find out more. Go to Tanium, Tanium.com/twit. You know those silos are not good for you. You know it. So do something about it. Tanium.com/twit. We thank him so much for supporting Security Now. And remind you that you support Steve's work, too, when you use that address. That way they know you saw it or heard it here. Tanium.com/twit. All right. Picture of the week time, Steve.
Okay. So this is two captures from Star Trek, the original series. And I titled this Captain, We Cannot Go to Warp. So the first one is from Kirk's vantage point, looking out across Sulu on the left and Chekhov on the right, and to the view screen at the front of the bridge, where we see the little what I call the roller coaster dots and a blue screen, the little spinner saying working on updates 30%. And, you know, and we see Chekhov sort of like turning his head back to look at Kirk, presumably saying, "Captain, we cannot go to warp." And the second frame is a very unhappy looking James Tiberius Kirk, kind of like growling because, you know, he wants to go to warp. And no, his ship will not let him. And I will note, we'll be talking about this later in Miscellany, but Uhura back there, ever present on the bridge through all of the original series and all six movies as well. So anyway, yes, James is not happy that he's having to wait for his starship to update. And Lord help us, if Windows is embedded into future starships, please don't let that happen. Everybody has always wanted me to write like a Windows operating system, Leo. And
oh,
I would.
No. Come on.
If it, well, I mean, I'm not going to. I've said no many times. But there's like, imagine if Steve wrote Windows. Well, I'm not going to do that. But okay, if anyone tried to stick it into a starship, okay, I would write that operating system. I'm just saying. If that's what it takes not to have updates ever, then fine. I'll step up. Okay. So the Australian software company Atlassian offers something called Confluence, which is a web-based corporate wiki written quite a while ago, 18 years ago, back in 2004 in Java.
It's and one we of use it, actually, and have for years.
Oh,
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
It's one of Atlassian's more popular products. It's packaged as a standalone turnkey that includes a built-in Tomcat web server. And the database is HSQL DB, which is also a Java-based database. So it makes sense that that's what it would choose, although other databases can be used with Confluence. It's modern collaborative software. It's used to help teams collaborate and share knowledge. In a corporate setting, it's used, for example, to capture project requirements, assign tasks to specific users, and manage one or more calendars. It's typically used on-premise in all over the place, in both in corporate, enterprise, and government environments. So,
and now I'm waiting for the other shoe to drop. Is there a...
That was the good news.
Yeah.
We're talking about it today because it appears to have recently come to the attention of ever prolific attackers who, based on the troubles it's been having recently, it's come to their attention because it's been, you know, vulnerabilities have been surfacing. And unfortunately, as with any product that was first written 18 years ago, before today's hyper-attack-aware climate existed, some of its coding practices from back then appear to be being turned into vulnerabilities. Now, although Confluence has recently suffered, as I said, from a series of troubles, it popped up again just last week due to a very serious problem with the installation of, believe it or not, default hard-coded credentials. As we know, anytime you hear that a problem has been created by the discovery of the default hard-coded credentials, you know, meaning a username and password with privileges no one should have, by default being part of an installation, it's difficult to chalk that up to anything other than some previous very bad decision. In this instance, the trouble arises from the installation of an app called Questions for Confluence. So it's not the core Confluence server itself. It's an add-on app. It's often installed on Confluence server and data center on-premises instances because it allows employees to ask questions and receive answers from a company's various internal departments. The installation of this Questions for Confluence app creates a user named the user's name is disabled system user, with the username disabled system user and the email of don't delete this user at email.com. So, you know, fake email placeholder, but disabled system user as the name of the account and the name of the user. And unfortunately, contrary to the name given to the account, it's not at all disabled, although it is indeed a system user. Atlassian released a patch that disables this built-in hard-coded account 13 days ago on July 20th. However, Confluence server admins did not have much time to install Atlassian's fix because, through no fault of Atlassian's, the system account username and credentials for this account were posted the next day to Twitter by someone using the handle Annoyed Researcher.
Oh.
Okay. I don't know the backstory for that, but it's uncool, right, to do that under any circumstances. I don't care how annoyed somebody is. That's just not the way it's done. You, in fact, I would argue you cannot call yourself a researcher, no matter how annoyed you may be, if you're, you know, posting credentials for a just released flaw that no one will have had time to fix.
You have to do responsible disclosure. That's just everybody has to do that. Yeah.
So as things go these days, it didn't take the bad guys long to put annoyed researchers' information to nefarious use. The cybersecurity firms, both of them, Gray Noise and Rapid7, both reported seeing immediate and continuing exploitation of this. I guess we'll call it a vulnerability, although it's hard to chalk up, you know, hard-coded credentials. No, I guess it is a vulnerability. It's not like they broadcasted it, but still shouldn't be done. It's the kind of thing you do by policy rather than by mistake. I guess that's the problem I'm having. Anyway, within days of the release of the patch, it was being used in attacks. CISA has stepped up and urged Confluence server owners to check to see if the vulnerable app has been installed on their servers, and if so, to install Atlassian's past patches. And Atlassian noted that disabling the app, due to the nature of the problem, doesn't fix the issue because it's the app's installation that created the problem by creating this instantiation of this non-disabled disabled user. So Confluence server owners must either install the security fixes or manually disable that hard-coded disabled system user account, which was created by this Questions for Confluence app. So anyway, because this thing, I mean, I've been seeing Confluence problems pass by, and they just haven't risen to the level of bringing them to our listeners' attention. But this one really seemed like it was important enough that, you know, you just want to make sure that if you're using this thing, that you've responded to Atlassian's security fix and or you know, killed or disabled that user. And in fact, Kevin Beaumont, the true security researcher who tweets as Gossy the Dog, he said, "I would recommend Confluence be placed behind a VPN or reverse proxy." And he says, for example, as your app proxy, he says, requiring authentication. He said, "It's simply too historically vulnerable to leave online. You're a sitting duck," was his tweet. And, you know, it's difficult to argue with Kevin's logic. Everyone knows that I think this should be standard practice now for all publicly exposed services. The rule would be don't publicly expose anything that doesn't utterly and absolutely, by definition, need to be publicly exposed. So what does? Web servers, obviously need to be publicly exposed by definition. So does email and probably DNS, although I even managed to not have my DNS publicly exposed. I use Level 3's Big Iron DNS servers as masters as slaves to my master. So the DNS, the only DNS that my system allows is zone transfers from my two designated name servers for GRC.com, which are Level 3 monster DNS servers. And who knows, they're probably, you know, virtualized and distributed and, you know, not even actual single machines anymore. But anyway, I guess the point is, it is possible to absolutely protect all of an enterprise's stuff by putting them behind, and this is what Kevin is talking about, an additional layer of authentication. You know, put them behind a VPN, put them behind some additional boundary that requires authentication, and only then are you able to get to it. Or use an overlay network, and, you know, and stick them on an overlay network so that the people have to authenticate to that in order to get there. But just don't have them as a public IP and port that Shodan is going to index so that the bad guys can jump on whatever it is the instant a problem is found. I mean, that's the model today. So the only sane response to today's reality is, no matter what it is, no matter how secure you think it is, give it additional protection. It has to be the way we roll. And I've been following my own advice from, like, before we started talking about this. During next week's 31st USENIX Security Conference, being held Wednesday through Friday, the 10th through the 12th in Boston, Massachusetts, a team of security researchers will be unveiling what they call TLS Anvil. And I guess the point of the name is to use this TLS Anvil to forge fully secure and compliant TLS connection libraries, because that's what it's designed to test. In the description of their forthcoming talk, which, as I said, they'll be giving at the end of next week, they explain. They said, although the newest versions of TLS are considered secure, flawed implementations may undermine the promised security properties. Such implementation flaws result from the TLS specification's complexity, with exponentially many possible parameter combinations. Combinatorial testing, which they abbreviate CT throughout their work, is a technique to tame this complexity. But it is hard to apply to TLS due to semantic dependencies between the parameters, and thus leaves the developers with a major challenge referred to as the test oracle problem, which is determining if the observed behavior of software is correct for a given test input. In this work, they write, we present TLS Anvil, a test suite based on combinatorial testing that can be efficiently efficiently and systematically test parameter value combinations and overcome the oracle problem by dynamically extracting an implementation-specific input parameter model that we constrained based on TLS-specific parameter value interactions. Our approach thus carefully restricts the available input space, which in turn allows us to reliably solve the oracle problem for any combination of values generated by the combinatorial testing algorithm. And finally, they say, we evaluated TLS Anvil against 13 well-known TLS implementations, including OpenSSL, Boring SSL, and NSS, you know, Netscape's security suite. This is, you know, for the original one. Our evaluation revealed 2 new exploits in Matrix SSL, 5 issues directly influencing the cryptographic operations of a session, which they refer to as handshakes at the handshake level, as well as 15 interoperability issues, 116 problems related to incorrect alert handling, and 100 other issues across all tested libraries. So needless to say, this was worth doing. And it is just so cool that we have a world where academics are able to tackle something this complex. All of this mumbo jumbo about combinatorial testing and input parameter modeling and testing oracles. The point is, we could reduce all that to testing TLS is hard. We did it anyway. Their paper is really interesting. I've got the link to it in the show notes for anybody who is interested. Excuse me. The 13 libraries that they tested were Bear SSL, Boring SSL, Botan, GNU TLS, Libre SSL, Matrix SSL, Embed TLS, NSS, Open SSL, Rust TLS, S to N, TLS Lite hyphen NG, and Wolf SSL. As it happens, through the years, we've talked about most, if not all, of these. They're all familiar to me. I'm sure they are to our listeners, those who have been with us the longest, at least. And recall, for example, that S to N is Amazon's from scratch open source implementation of TLS. They wrote it because of AWS. They needed, a TLS for their own cloud services. But they observed that OpenSSL, as we've often observed, had grown in size to 500,000 lines of code, 70,000 of which were tied to SSL, TLS processing. But they could be replaced, and they did replace them, with about 6,000 lines of code, which Amazon observed is far easier to audit and to actually have some sense of knowing what the code is actually doing. How could you do that with 500,000 when they're all tangled up with each other? So anyway, this chart, which you had on the screen earlier, Leo, thank you, in their paper, gives us a cross-reference to those 13 TLS proposed libraries with the number of different type of exploits found, problems with the handshake crypto, problems affecting client and server interoperability, the generation of alerts, which is to say in the protocol, when either end does something illegal, the other end is supposed to send an alert and disconnect. It's like, you're bad and I'm hanging up on you. And then other problems. Their paper was 18 pages. I'm not going to go into it, in great detail, but they definitely found problems of varying degrees in every one of the 13 TLS libraries. And looking over the chart, it appears that the best libraries were Boring SSL, Botan, NSS, OpenSSL, and Amazon's S to N, as well as TLS Lite. These guys now really understand the state of play with the industry's TLS support. They wound up having, creating the tool, running the libraries against it, and then having to sit back and ask themselves, it's not exactly what we expected. We didn't know what we were going to get. How do we decide to think about this? And they ended up defining 2 degrees of success. for this test. They wrote, a strictly succeeded test means that a library behaved exactly as expected. If multiple test cases are performed during the execution of a test template, the system under test must have behaved correctly across every one of them. But then they also created a softer, gentler definition. They said a conceptually succeeded test means that an implementation did not precisely fulfill the RFC requirements or did not do so in all test cases, but effectively behaved correctly. And I'll explain what happened in a minute, because they when they had this thing, they then, to be responsible, they needed to talk to the implementers. And it's actually the case that the implementers convinced them that it was necessary not to be strict. So they said, okay, let's just be conceptual then. That's good, right? So they said, for example, this usually applies to tests where a fatal alert was expected, but the library either only closed the connection but did not send an alert first, or the alert description did not match the RFC specification. So we should understand that these guys implemented TLS Anvil strictly from the RFCs. That was their starting point, was, you know, what does the spec say the library must do in each and every case? And the act of testing that, I mean, we don't know what internal tests TLS developers may have, but if we presume that they've been using their internal tests, and how could you not, then this TLS Anvil's results suggest that in at least some cases those internal tests were wanting. So they then give some examples of what they found. They said, we count all tests as passed that either succeeded strictly or conceptually, and now we know what that means, and include the percentage of passed tests. We further list the ratio of conceptually to strictly succeeded tests as an additional metric to compare how close an implementation is to the RFC for our tests. Rust TLS, for example, passed many tests, but most of them only succeeded conceptually, as Rust often did not send any alerts. And again, it's like you're supposed to send an alert to tell the other end why it just misbehaved. But, you know, Rust just said, you know, F off and disconnected, which
you could argue nothing.
It gets the message across. And Botan, in contrast, often fulfilled the expectations, they wrote, of our tests, and at the same time was very accurate with alert descriptions.
Good.
They said, we generally found that most libraries pass a high ratio of the test templates, with NSS, Boring SSL, TLS Lite NG, and OpenSSL passing around 97%, which I think is really good, of their applied server tests. Among the client tests, so of course server tests meaning that you're using the library to accept connections, client tests meaning you're using the library to generate new TLS connections to a remote server. So they said among the client tests, Bare SSL, Boring SSL, and Botan have the highest ratio of passed tests with 97.3, 96.8, and 96.2, respectively. They said, we expand upon the results of libraries with significantly worse ratios, listing how many test templates of an RFC passed and how many were executed for each library. We grouped the results of test templates based on similar error cases and identified a total of 239 issues. We further categorized these findings based on their impact and determined that three immediately led to exploits in Wolf SSL and Matrix SSL. In other words, you know, exploitable problems in those libraries. They're gone now, so long as you've updated recently, because these guys were doing all of this work, you know, before they went public and gave everybody plenty of time to fix. They said, additionally, we found five issues affecting the cryptography of a handshake. As an example, the clients of Matrix SSL and Amazon's S2N and Wolf SSL are willing to negotiate parameters they did not offer, which is interesting and, you know, not good. And they said, while none of the parameters negotiated are sufficiently weakening the security to pose an immediate threat now, parameter negotiation is a basic security property of every cryptographic protocol to prevent current and potential future attacks. So again, another nice thing that these guys checked, which the authors of Matrix SSL, S2N, meaning Amazon, and Wolf SSL missed. So now they know, and presumably they have fixed that. They said, we identified 15 issues affecting the interoperability to an extent where a peer that operates within the boundaries of the RFC may not be able to complete a handshake. They said, note that this may also include intentional deviations by the developers if they break the implementation's correctness in regards to the specification. They said 100 issues account for various likely but uncritical cases where a library deviated from the RFC beyond alert codes and where interoperability should not be affected. Examples of these findings are a bug in OpenSSL, which allowed multiple TLS 1.3 hello retry request messages, which can keep the client in a handshake loop. Okay, again, like technically a violation of the RFC, but nothing to worry about. But still, what's interesting about these is if that isn't what the developers intended, then getting them to look at why that happened could reveal some other side effect of this. So always good to at least be sure you know why you deviated from the intended behavior. They said, finally, we grouped 116 cases where a library did not send an alert or sent a different alert than requested by the RFC. These are minor deviations from the standard. However, in the past, information gained from the type of alert sent by an implementation has been used to mount side channel attacks. They say to avoid such deviations, great care must be taken when designing the alert handling of an implementation. We hence chose to include these findings in our report to the developers, and meaning that they then, after creating this, produced a comprehensive report to each of the 13 developers of these packages. And what they had to say about responsible disclosure and feedback, I thought, was very interesting. They said, we responsibly disclosed all of our findings to the respective developers. During the disclosure process, multiple developers stated that they intentionally violate RFC requirements in specific cases. As an example, in TLS 1.2, peers are not allowed to resume a session that has been terminated by a fatal alert. However, when multiple sessions take place in parallel, this requirement is difficult to implement. Okay, so what I loved about that was that the ivory tower developers of the RFC said, you know, if a peer terminates with a fatal alert, then you're not allowed to resume a session. But the guys who implemented this or attempted to said, okay, what do we do about multiple parallel sessions? You didn't say, you didn't tell us what to do. So these guys went one way that the TLS Anvil guys took issue with. They said multiple developers also stated that they intentionally send different alerts or no alerts at all, intentionally. One reason was to minimize the risk of creating an alert oracle for attacks. And you know, and these guys themselves mentioned that in the past, the alerts that were sent had been used, had been leveraged in side channels. However, now they say, we do, however, stress that the specified alert handling of current TLS RFCs does not result in a known exploitable oracle, but is considered to be secure. So they're saying, it's not a good excuse. They said our original test suite contained 18 additional test templates, which we removed from the test suite after discussions with different library developers. Their reasoning convinced us that in these cases, our interpretation of the RFC was too strict and that their library behavior was indeed valid. Very cool. So they said our presented evaluation does not contain these additional test templates anymore. There were some cases where the developers argued that it is unreasonable to follow the specification. For example, in some tests, a server that supports both TLS 1.3 and TLS 1.2 would need different alert handling for the same effective test. The situation becomes even more tricky when the server has not decided which protocol version to speak yet. Right? So, again, two different protocol versions require different alerts to be responded to respond differently with alerts depending upon the problem. Yet at this stage in the handshake, the version that's being negotiated hasn't been determined, and it could be either of them. So again, you know, I love the fact that these guys were so insanely rigorous that they're edge cases, clearly, but I mean, they're like an edge case's edge case, you know, yet they came out as a consequence of this. So they said, for example, a server that receives a malformed or illegal client hello message would first need to evaluate the supported version of the client to decide upon the correct alert handling rules. Correctly handling these nuances, they said, can be complex, and it is arguable whether the strict RFC conformance across all supported versions is worth the added complexity. And they finished, the security bugs we reported and most of our other reports have been acknowledged by the developers and will be considered for future releases. You know, none were you know, run around screaming immediately patch, or they would have been done already. Since most failed test templates only failed for single or very few libraries, we conclude that the developers in general share our understanding of the RFCs. So just so cool. You know, and I guess another way to read this would be ivory tower RFCs meet real world implementations. There are some places where it just doesn't make sufficient sense to go to all the trouble that absolute slavish adherence to the RFCs would require. Anyway, all this beautiful work is on GitHub. The site is tls-anvil.com, which offers dockers to allow the use of these tests by anyone. And I'm just, you know, I salute this. This is precisely the sort of work that we need and as much of it as we can get. So bravo to these guys. Very, very cool work. And it now exists. So it can, if, you know, if there's a 1.4, then the suites, the test suites can be augmented to incorporate that. You know, this ends up being a benchmark reference against which TLS suites can be tested. And I just, that's so cool. And Leo,
yes.
What isn't is my throat. It is overheated.
Well, take a break. Relax. We don't want to wear you out. But I do want to tell everybody about IT Pro TV, and especially want to tell people about IT Pro TV if they're looking to get into IT. I know a lot of you are. And IT Pro TV is a great way to get the knowledge you need, to get the certifications you need to get that first job. And, of course, if you're already in IT, it's a great way to add to your skills, get new certs, recertify. IT Pro TV makes it engaging and fun. Their hosts, they call them edutainers, are, of course, first and foremost experts in the field. But their enthusiasm and passion for what they're doing really communicates and makes it fun to watch. And you can do it on your own and schedule their 20 to 30 minute long segments. And you can binge them if you want. There's 5,800 hours of IT training, always up to date because they've got 7 studios running all day, Monday through Friday, updating this, getting the latest versions as the tests change, as the software changes, as new certs come out. You can watch it anywhere you want on a desktop, of course, in a browser, Apple TV. There's an IT Pro TV app, Roku. You can watch it on your tablet, your mobile device, too. I mean, it really makes it easy to learn and fun. And with their virtual labs and their practice tests, IT Pro TV makes sure you'll be ready with the hands-on knowledge you need. And you'll kind of be prepared for the tests because you've taken them already. And I think that really helps. One reviewer said, quote, best website to study IT and cybersecurity-related courses. I like the part where they make a few courses free for a weekend. They do that every month, and it's great. In fact, for August, they're going to do, I think, one that everybody interested in IT should go and look at, Getting Started in IT. It's free the weekend of August 13th and 14th. That's a couple of weeks from now. They're going to have 2 free live webinars, August 4th, which is this Thursday. Don Pezette will do How to Get into IT, and this is a Q&A with one of their founders. So that's a really great opportunity to ask your questions. So if you can't be there live Thursday, August 4th, 2 p.m. Eastern, if you can't, of course, it'll be on demand. But if you want to ask those questions, be there live August 4th, 2 p.m. Eastern. And then All Things Cybersecurity, that's with Ben Finke on Thursday, August 18th, also 2 p.m. Eastern. New IT training episodes, of course, are added to their library every day. In fact, today you can step into the booming cloud world with IT Pro TV's AWS Cloud Practitioner Training. AWS Cloud Practitioner. It's a course that gives you everything you need to get that cert and then get on your way to a career in the cloud. And if I think for a lot of people already in IT, this is an area you'd like to get into. What a great way to do it. So register right now, go.itpro.tv/AWS-cloud-practitioner. Did you get that? go.itpro.tv/AWS-cloud-practitioner. And of course, if you've got a business and you've got an IT team, IT Pro TV has a great business plan for you too. A great way to get your team up. Skilled up, upskilled, I guess they called it, and ready to face any challenge. Again, itpro.tv/securitynow. If you want to sign up, you can get an additional 30% off all consumer subscriptions for the lifetime of your active subscription. Just use the code SN30. That's nice if you do, because then they know you saw it here, and that helps us a lot. So itpro.tv/securitynow, all one word, and the code is SN30. An additional 30% off. As long as you stay active, you pay 30% less. That's a great deal. IT Pro TV. Build or expand your IT career and enjoy the journey. itpro.tv/securitynow. And now we go back to you, Steve, and more great security stuff.
So, Google, Last Wednesday,
they keep putting this off, don't they? They keep putting it off.
And I guess I'm sympathetic because I recognize we all should recognize how difficult change is.
Yes.
If there's one of the, you know, the overriding themes of the podcast's lessons, it would be change is hard and nobody wants it. Just you know, say IPv6 and you can rest your case. Anyway, their VP of the Privacy Sandbox Initiative, Anthony Chavez, said last Wednesday, "The most consistent feedback we've received is the need for more time." Right. It's not Google. No. They're not ready us. To pull the plug.
Oh, yeah.
That's right. The more time to evaluate and test the new privacy sandbox technologies before deprecating third-party cookies in Chrome. This feedback, he wrote, aligns with our commitment to the CMA, we'll get to that in a second, to ensure that the privacy sandbox provides effective privacy-preserving technologies and the industry has sufficient time to adopt these new solutions. Now, okay, I would argue that the industry will not adopt anything until you pull the plug on the old solutions and you've said, hey, we told you we were going to pull the plug. We gave you plenty of time. We're sorry the cookies are gone and you can't track anybody anymore. Here's the API that, you know, we created to let you do that. So, you know, start doing it. Again, no, it's like, okay, again, the lesson we keep seeing is you have to make people change. Okay, so anyway, let's back up a bit. Google once again delayed its plan to terminate Chrome's support for third-party cookies is what this amounts to. They first unveiled this privacy sandbox initiative back in 2019, when my mustache was a little less gray, with the announcement that its implementation would begin this year in 2022, meaning that this would be the only way to do, what do we call it, interest-based advertising or something. I'm sure there's a term. Anyway, last year, after being scrutinized by the UK's Competition and Markets Authority, that's that CMA that Anthony referred to, and the US DOJ, our Department of Justice, Google announced their intention to delay their third-party cookie phase-out until the middle of next year, so 2013. And now, last Wednesday, what Anthony is announcing is another delay, saying that now it won't be, I saw August of 2024 somewhere, but, you know, basically they won't end, they're promising not to end support for third-party cookies before the second half of 2024. And again, my feeling is just do it. Just, you know, have the system in place, have it well tested, have it working, and then end the way it used to be. And make people switch. And, you know, in 2 years, are we still going to be here in 2 years? I think we are, Leo. Yeah. So we'll get to see what happens in the second half of 2024. We'll be right here. Under its current timeline, Google will expand the availability of its privacy sandbox trial to what they said was millions of users globally, meaning that Chrome will begin to get this technology. And they're saying by early next month, so early September, millions of users using Chrome will have this, what we've talked about before, the Topics API will be live. Then they plan to gradually roll out the test to more and more users throughout the rest of 2022 and 2023. They hope to officially launch the Privacy Sandbox APIs by the third quarter of 2023, meaning, okay, about a year from now. Anthony said, quote, "This deliberate approach to transitioning from third-party cookies ensures that the world can continue to thrive," thrive, "without
the world.
Relying..."
You mean the advertisers.
"Yeah, without relying on cross-site tracking identifiers or covert techniques like fingerprinting." Okay, so, you know, on the podcast, we've talked, about, and we've been, if you'll pardon the choice of words, we've been tracking Google's proposed tracking technologies closely. Their first attempt at replacing third-party cookies was their awkwardly named Federated Learning of Cohorts, you know, Flock, which, as Leo, you grabbed the fact that that was about birds, which, you know.
All of the code names in that generation were bird-focused.
Right. Yeah. Then, when that failed to take off, largely because no one understood how it worked and it was way too opaque, Google announced their new approach called Topics, which is largely the same but is far more understandable and inherently transparent in the way it works. And as the name suggests, and we did a podcast on this, so we've completely covered this, Topics more transparently, it works more transparently and makes it obvious how and what interests it is sharing with websites that users visit. It's got about 300 different topics. And when a user visits a website that requests the information, Chrome will offer from a pool three different topics in a random sequence that it knows that the user is interested in. So it's sufficiently cloudy, fuzzy, that you can't track a user by seeing what topics their browser is offering from one site to the next. The site's publisher then, that is the site's server that receives these three randomly selected from a larger pool that the user has shown their interest in by virtue of where they've gone to the sites they've visited in the past, that server can then choose to share that information with their advertisers, which they certainly would. Okay, and being a technology hound, I understand and love these initiatives from Google. They make sense to me. But the big question in my mind will be whether any of this can actually replace all other side channel tracking. You know, as we've observed, if you turn off cookies, bad guys will just, or gray guys, will just use some other means of tracking, like fingerprints, all of the, the stuff that the Panopticlick site shows is leaking from our browsers. I think that the only way we're ever going to be free of tracking altogether is through legislation, which makes it flatly and permanently illegal. We'll first need a privacy-protecting replacement, which Google's Topics does offer. But once that's in place, we're going to need governmental regulation, probably led by the EU, since they seem to have a penchant for that, to completely outlaw any and all other forms of anonymous internet user identification, aside from the use of the sanctioned API, which will hopefully become an industry-wide standard and, I think has the chance to. So, again, it's going to have everybody, every step of the way, this is going to require people being forced to change. So far, it's already been slow and painful. I don't see any reason for that to be any different. Google's got this thing in place. They've got to stop moving the goalposts, or no one's ever going to believe that they're going to be serious. So hopefully, latter half of 2024, we'll finally see Chrome remove third-party cookies completely, altogether from the Chromium core. And by that time, Topics will have been around long enough so that if somebody says, wait a minute, how are we supposed to track people? It's like, well, you're supposed to use Topics, and it's been around for a couple of years, so it's your fault if you're not.
It's going to be a race, because that's about episode 990 or about. It'll be a race between weather.
Wait, we have our I was just going to say we have our birthday on August 19th, but that's not that doesn't correspond with episode 999 because that
fortunately
doesn't
divide it does not
into 52. Right?
Thank goodness. But yeah, it's going to be a race between whether Google clobbers third party cookies or you clobber security now. Which will happen first? No one knows. Yeah, you can back out, Steve. It's not a permanent, you know. I'm glad to hear you saying that. No one wants you to stop.
Okay. Well,
all right.
We'll see how it goes. We have to hang it. Well, no, I'm not making any.
Don't say anything. Just William, I'm going to get there.
Don't say anything.
We'll see what happens when the time comes.
Okay. So, Proofpoint released the results of their email based malware attack analysis. In their report, they observed that their analysis of campaign threats, meaning, you know, malware campaigns, which include threats manually analyzed and contextualized by Proofpoint's threat researchers, they found that the use of macro-enabled attachments by threat actors had decreased approximately 66%, meaning it's dropped to one-third of what it was before, between October 2021 and last month, June 2022. And remember that Microsoft previously announced it would begin to block XL4 and VBA macros by default for Office users in October of 2021 for XL4, which coincides exactly with the beginning of the observed drop in their use.
Yes.
And also in February of this year for VBA. And as we know, there was some confusion last month by Microsoft saying, we're not sure. And okay, now we are again, but now it's going to just be a documentation change. The disabling has ultimately remained in place, thank goodness. So, not surprisingly, threat actors across the landscape have responded by shifting away from macro-based threats even before it had, like, the boom had been lowered, because they knew that, you know, the way they'd been doing it was going to end. Based on Proofpoint's campaign data since October 21, threat actors have pivoted from using macro-enabled documents attached directly to messages to deliver malware, and have increasingly been using container files, such as ISOs and RAR attachments, and Windows shortcut, you know, .lnk link files. So what's going on is that Microsoft blocks VBA macros based on the so-called, and I love this, the mark of the web, which tags files based upon their source. The mark of the web identifies whether a file originated from the internet zone within their computer. And the mark of the web, I just love saying that, tags the file that's downloaded. But it cannot tag files contained within other files, right? So the mark of the web can be bypassed by using a container file format. An IT security company, Outflank, that's a great name, has detailed multiple options for red teamers to bypass, as it's the acronym, of course, is MOTW, Mark of the Web, mechanisms. And, of course, these techniques can be used by threat actors as well. Threat actors can use container file formats such as I mentioned, ISO, RAR, ZIP, and IMG, you know, image files, to sneak macro-enabled documents into a user's machine, bypassing that flagging. The container gets flagged, but of course its contents do not. So the file system will not identify the document as coming from the web, and some of these new defenses will be bypassed. And, you know, it occurs to me, Microsoft, hello, Microsoft, are you listening? Why not mark the contents of containers? You know, you're marking the file, mark the contents. Maybe they can't because the mark of the web is an NTFS property, and so you probably can't reach in. But if you watched the container being decontainerized, then you know you could get smarter, Microsoft. So maybe you need to get smarter. Anyway, the cat and the mouse race continues. Having Microsoft finally hampering, thank goodness, the auto-running of these macros by default was a huge leap forward. I'm still somewhat amazed by the amount of pushback that Microsoft received. You know, people want to have the power without being willing to take responsibility for what having it means. So Microsoft finally, after decades, did the right thing by simply taking that power away while providing them with ample safe workarounds. And again, I would argue Google is going to have to do the same thing. They're going to end up pulling the plug on third-party cookies and people are going to scream. And the good news is they will have had years to adapt their technology. So pull the plug anyway, Google. Okay, Lewis. Who hangs out in the SpinRight.dev news group, he wrote sometime between last week and this week, he said, I was surprised to hear this week that SpinRight 6.1 is still using 16-bit addressing, limiting it to 64K. And then he said, I forgot the word used, and he means segments, 64K segments. He says, is this actually helpful in 2022? And wouldn't it be simpler for the code to use 32-bit addresses rather than swap between 64K blocks? And he finished, haven't we been at 32 bits for almost 40 years? Okay, so Lewis's question raises an interesting point about practical computing and computer science that I wanted to take a moment to address. So let's, for a minute, delve into some theoretical aspects of computer science, which not everyone may have stopped to consider. Okay, first of all, let's understand that whatever they are being used for, the number of binary bits collected together determines the number of possible states that the collection of bits can have. We might be using a collection of bits to represent a value, in which case the number of bits determines the number of possible discrete values that can be represented by that collection. Or the collection of bits might be a cryptographic key, in which case the number of bits in the collection determines how many wrong keys that one right key is hiding among. Or the collection of bits might be a pointer to one object in a linear array of other objects. In that case, the number of bits in the collection determines how many discrete objects that collection of bits is able to refer to. So far, it would appear that the more bits, the merrier. After all, what's wrong with being able to represent more values than you might need to? Or what's wrong with being able to refer to more objects than you could have? In all cases, logic would suggest that there will be some minimum number of bits required to do the job, but that having unused bits would not be a problem. There are at least two problems with having unneeded and unused bits. One is power consumption. All other things being equal, and they pretty much are, 32 bits consumes 4 times the power of 8 bits. And those 32 bits consume equal amounts of power, whether they are zeros or ones, because they still need to be checked and moved around. And speaking of moving them around, whatever the bit size is, that is, the size of the collection, all of those bits need to be moved around. They probably need to be loaded and stored from and to main memory. But as we know, memory bandwidth has become one of the limiting and crippling factors in modern computing. Since main memory has been unable to keep up with our data-hungry processors, all manner of multi-level caching has been deployed in an attempt to decouple the slow main memory from our super-fast, super-hungry CPUs. So, if a CPU is using 32 bits to refer to a small collection of objects that could be referred to by only 8 bits, then 24 bits out of the 32 bits of precious memory bandwidth are being completely wasted. The CPU is only obtaining 25% of the system's possible memory bandwidth if, as in this example, 32 bits are being used where 8 bits would have been sufficient. The other consequence of unused bits is the size of the program's code and data. If the code is using 32 bits, where 8 would have been sufficient, the resulting code will be much larger, by as much as 4 times. That means it takes as much as 4 times more space, takes 4 times longer to load, and runs as much as 1/4 the speed, since there's just so much more code bulk for the CPU to slog through. So this all tells us that the theoretical optimal number of bits to use would be just as many bits as are required, but no more. In fact, there were, back in the early days of digital computer design, variable bit length computers. Early serial memories such as paper tape and magnetic tape, drum and delay line did not inherently bring along any natural boundaries. So they worked well with the idea of variable bit length computing. And remember, back in the 40s and 50s, this was all being invented. No one knew back then what answer would be best, what the answer would be. So who knew? Perhaps variable length computing would turn out to be the best. But when core memory was invented, it turned out to be far more convenient to stack the planes of core memory grids and to read out a fixed number of bits in parallel, one from each plane of memory. So it became natural for computers to load and store data in the same bit lengths as the core memory could produce and consume per cycle. And that approach of grouping data bits into bytes and into words, having fixed lengths, has stuck with us ever since. So what does all this have to do with SpinRite? SpinRite was born when the IBM PC was using the 8088 x86 chip. It had 16-bit registers and 20 bits of addressing. The 16-bit registers could represent 64K different values, and 20 bits of addressing could refer to 1 megabyte of RAM. But back then, 1 megabyte was so much memory that it wasn't even standard. It was quite common for the first PCs to have 256K or 512K of RAM, because programs back then were small, efficient, and really didn't do very much. The PC's BIOS, MS-DOS, and all of the DOS clones were, and still are today, 16-bit code. And they would only run 16-bit programs. Yet an incredible amount of work was accomplished by WordStar, WordPerfect, VisiCalc, Lotus 1-2-3, DBase 3, FoxPro, and many other 16-bit programs, including SpinRite. Today, SpinRite is a 16-bit program because it's still running on the 16-bit DOS operating system. And even today, I'm not unhappy about that, because most of what SpinRite is doing fits nicely into 16 bits. And again, as we've just seen, more bits is not always better. But even back then, many of those other programs were bursting at their seams within the constraints imposed by 16-bit code. SpinWrite wasn't one of them. But the PC's memory was first expanded, and then it was extended using elaborate page swapping schemes to allow data-hungry tools like Lotus 1-2-3 to operate upon much larger data sets. And toward the end of all that, DOS extenders were created to host true 32-bit programs on poor old 16-bit DOS. Doing this was an act of sheer desperation. It was the definition of kludge, because DOS could still only run under the CPU's real mode, and protected mode was required to go beyond 16 bits to true 32 bits. So the CPU was being dynamically switched back and forth on the fly between real mode and protected mode. It was a mess. But SpinWrite is not pure 16-bit code. It's true that it's running in real mode alongside the 16-bit BIOS and 16-bit DOS. But SpinWrite 6.1, not 6.0, but 6.1, takes advantage of what must have been an inadvertent bug in the way the very first 8286 chips operated, and which that bug has appeared in every chip since, because Intel must have been worried about breaking backward compatibility if they were to fix this bug. The bug arises from the fact that the limitations inherent in the 8088s and 8086s real mode, which is the only mode they had, can be simulated by protected mode. So the 8286 chips and all of the chips which have followed don't actually have real mode. They have what amounts to a clamped down protected mode with full access to the system's I/O hardware. So there are no restrictions there. They're basically simulating real mode, and there was always a subtle bug in that simulation. Since I've talked about this before in greater detail, I won't go into it again, but suffice to say that SpinWrite uses this bug to obtain 32-bit access to any machine's first 4 gigabytes of RAM from within 16-bit real mode code. It's kind of the best of both worlds. SpinWrite itself remains small, with most of it remaining pure 16-bit code. But when and as necessary, it's able to directly address any memory that's accessible with 32 bits, which is 4 gig. Doing this was necessary in order to obtain the absolute maximum possible performance from AHCI-connected drives. And boy, will it be necessary for NVMe under SpinWrite 7. Because it's able to read very large 32K sector 16 megabyte blocks with a single command all at once. And boy, we've seen what that means. But in real mode, the program counter, which points to instructions, is still 16 bits long. So code must be executed within 64K byte blocks. And one of those is what SpinWrite has outgrown, thus now needing a second code segment block to contain its growth. Once SpinWrite 6.1 is finished and published, I plan to immediately begin the work of recoding 16-bit SpinWrite into true, pure 32-bit code, because it is moving to a 32-bit operating system in order to be able to boot over UEFI. So, oh,
interesting. Is it still free DOS or?
No, because no DOS will ever be 32-bit. Okay. So it's not free DOS. I found a little embedded 32-bit protected mode real-time operating system which is like a perfect host for this, and it will be able to dual boot BIOS or UEFI. And that will just, you know, that basically takes all the limits off of what SpinRite will be able to do. You know, for example, in the future, running on all of a user's drives or a system's drives at once rather than one at a time.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah.
That's it'll a great thing.
It's going to be very cool. So anyway, I just sort of wanted to you know, just sort of touch on the reality that, you know, when I hear people especially talking about 64 bits, I just think, oh, really? Come on. I mean, again, there really are real world problems associated with having to shuffle all those bits back and forth if you don't need them. So, okay. Some feedback from our wonderful listeners. Oh, and Leo, you've forwarded this email to me this morning.
Yes, and you saw it too, apparently. Yes.
Yeah, I did. Jonathan Leitshu, I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly, Jonathan, Leitshuh. He tweeted two tweets yesterday, and as I said, followed up with a piece of email to the Twit gang. Anyway, I just wanted to share it. He's with the Open Source Summit, and he said at SGGRC and at Leo Laporte, I've been listening to at Security Now for years. This year, I'm speaking at Black Hat events and DEF CON.
Oh, wow.
And B-Sides LV, exclamation point. He said, I learned so much from your show. I wouldn't be where I am today without it. Thank you so much for the amazing education you've provided. And then in the next tweet, he continued, it's from your stories of great hackers like Tavis Ormandy and Dan Kaminsky and many others that I learned the norms of vulnerability disclosure. I learned the importance of building software that is secure by default.
That's nice.
So, Jonathan, thank you for the tweets and congratulations on being at Black Hat and DEF CON as a speaker.
Speaking of Dan Kaminsky, I forgot to tell you this, but Dan's mom, Trudy, was on the cruise with us.
Ah.
And you remember, you told quite a story about Dan's mom. She was quite famous defending her son. She told more stories like that on the cruise, including when he was 11, he'd been writing for computer magazines. And the computer publisher, not knowing he was 11, said, I've got a big project for you. And his mom, who was very protective, Trudy was amazing. It was really nice to meet her on this cruise. She was very protective. She said, you know, he's 11. And Dan was really mad at her, saying, well, I can do it. But yeah, she was great. And she had not heard your tribute to Dan. Of course, Dan, as we know, passed away last year. And it's at the age of 42. It was very tragic. Her friend who brought her on the cruise is going to play that tribute to Dan for her.
Good.
But she was, I think, really glad she came on the cruise. She'd been pretty depressed. And she came on and she got so much, adulation and got so much out of telling her stories about Dan to the group that I just thought I'd pass that along to you. It was kind of cool. Neat. Yeah. Thanks for joining us.
And an example of what you get with when you don't expect it on one of these cruises.
Besides COVID. Yeah.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. I said what you didn't expect.
Oh, yeah. I kind of expected the COVID. You're right. Did not expect Trudy. That's one of the fun things about meeting our audience. As you know, you've learned this. Our audience is very diverse and sometimes very interesting. One of the guys on there was Army Human Intelligence. I said, what do you do for the Army? He says, human. I said, oh, human. What's that? He says, well, I do interrogations. I was at Abu Ghraib. And I went, oh. And we had some very interesting conversations. Really fascinating stuff.
Very cool.
Some super smart, talented, interesting people. So as you know, it's always fun to go on these meetups and trips and so forth because
Laura and I had a ball when we were out traveling around, meeting everybody.
Oh, people love you. Yeah, of course.
So Alex Niehaus.
We know Alex well. Yeah.
We know him well. A great friend of the show. The very first sponsor that this podcast ever had.
Exactly right. Thank you, Alex.
He said, I especially enjoyed your and Leo's mirth at the astonishing flaws in the MV-720 in episode 881. He says, I worked in China in the mid-90s. This doesn't surprise me. It's a cultural thing, a fundamental business drive to maximize profit by cheapening the product. To which I say, well, God help us.
That's what you get.
Mark OJ, he said, hi, Steve, longtime listener here. Love your show. Just wanted to drop an information that there is an open source version of Tail Scale that is called Head Scale. That's kind of clever, head versus tail. Seems good alternative to the paid version available here. And a link to it at GitHub. So Head Scale is it. And I just wanted to pass that on because there is a community-supported Tail Scale, but they're pushing people to subscribe. And I would also head toward the free one. Someone tweeting as a Henning said, Dear Steve, just listen to GRC. Okay, he said a GRC 881. He means SN.
Close enough.
881. And your criticism of the way Microsoft implemented the protection against brute force password guesses. He said, parens, allow 10 failed logins, then ban any logins for 10 minutes, then allow 10 failed logins again, and so on. You asked why Microsoft did not block the logins indefinitely. And frankly, once he said it, I was like, duh, of course. He says, and this is my answer, because I designed a login system for our university's web applications that works the same way. If we would block accounts, then it would be easy for anyone of our aspiring computer science students to produce a small script that locks out all of our users.
Of course.
Uh-huh.
Oh.
In one night.
Duh. Just by attempting failed logins.
That's right.
You could lock
it
everybody out.
Completely prone to abuse.
See, you and I, but this is a problem all security has. We didn't think evil enough.
We did not think evil.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yep.
So,
wow.
Anyway, thank you
very much.
And to the other, a number of our listeners said, Steve, you know what the problem with that is? Yeah. It's like, yeah, I do now. I mean, yeah, thank you. Now, many of our XKCD following listeners sent me the following graphic. I've got it in the show notes, and it's cute. And so this is just classic XKCD. The little picture is titled Energy Tip. Increase the security of your home power supply by installing an air gap.
Yeah, now I get it.
And so it shows the cord coming in from the right to a flood lamp, which is aimed at and maybe like about a foot away from a solar panel that then has a cord coming from it to a little box, presumably an inverter, that turns the DC back into AC, and off it goes. And, of course, I loved the concept. It's funny. But the engineer in me immediately is appalled by the inefficiencies. You have inefficiency converting the electricity to light. You have the inefficiency of the light escaping in all sorts of directions. I mean, we can see the light bulb shining here from the side, so that's bad. Then we have the inefficiency that's inherent in solar to DC conversion, and the inefficiency of a DC to AC inverter. So, yes, I know I'm being far too pedantic, but I would not have my home air-gapped for that reason.
I don't think he's serious. I think it's
No. Just it's a wonderful cartoon. So thank you again, XKCD. You've provided us with many moments. Richard, somebody who's got his name as Richard COVID with five syringes and the word flu in his Twitter name. He liked our mention last week, and this is another bit of mirth from us, Leo, about this crazy Microsoft printer weird cloning copy creation, and I didn't include it in here, but he mentioned he had a long tweet that went with this picture showing Brother MFC J985DW printer, and then another identical one, parens copy one, and notice that it's the second one that has been set to default.
Yes, he solved it.
Yes, he noted that exactly this happened for reasons he was never able to figure out. Now he knows. The real one stopped working. The copy worked, and he said, "Okay, fine." He fixed it the way most people do. I'll just use that one. It's like, okay.
Wow, that's kludgy. Yeah.
Someone tweeting as Hiveware said at SGGRC, a little pushback on your Windows OS being creaky and brittle. He says, take a look at 11's settings controls. No longer are they a thin veneer over ancient code. They are beautiful. They are a beautiful evolution of the venerable property sheet control, top to bottom. Credit to MS where credit is due. Okay, so after reading this tweet and wanting to include it in the podcast for the sake of balance, I would like to be balanced, I thought I might have missed something. So I fired up a VirtualBox VM where I keep an instance of Windows 11 because, you know, it's not actually good for anything. And I went over to the settings controls after waiting for it to update itself somewhat endlessly, much like Kirk on the bridge. I was unable to go to warp drive or warp speed. So anyway, it looks, first of all, exactly like Windows 10. Perhaps I missed what Hiveware was referring to. But
it's beautiful.
I poked around.
What are you talking about? It's beautiful.
It's beautiful. Just like Windows 10.
Just like Windows 10.
So I poked around, and actually it was your discussion with Paul from last week, Leo, that led me to the control panel for sound. It looks exactly like what we had perhaps as far back as Windows 3.1.
It is, in fact, the old control panel. You nailed it.
Yes, it is. It is the old property sheet control.
Yeah.
Or go to Internet Options dialog. It's the same as we've had forever.
Yeah.
Or the device manager, the same as we've had. And I could go on and on. So, you know, he says, no longer are they a thin veneer over ancient code. Well, I think that's precisely what those ancient dialogues are.
Look at these. This is hysterical.
I know. I mean, nothing has changed.
This looks like XP.
They are ancient code.
Yeah.
And I think that's great because those are the parts of Windows that still work.
Right.
Most reliably.
In fact, when you want to change user settings, you don't want the thin veneer crap that Microsoft has given us. You want the old school.
Yeah. You don't want something that looks like a web page.
You don't want this. No. No, you don't. You don't. You want the old school. In fact,
so
many people have learned what the command is to open those old user property settings.
You know. Yep. So anyway, I didn't mean to diss on Hiveware, but I just, you know, I thought, okay, wait, am I missing something here? Maybe 11 did change everything, and I just haven't dug in deep enough. But no, it's still Windows 3.1 with, you know, I mean, it doesn't have the same borders and the same, you know, colors.
It's got rounded corners now. Come
and
on,
and for what
Steve.
It's worth, again, I'm happy that they're leaving the stuff alone that works.
Yeah.
Because for that reason, it works. Okay. I noted Uhura on the bridge behind Kirk at the top of our show notes. And I just wanted to make a mention of her passing this past weekend. Nichelle Nichols, at age 89, passed. And of course, she was Uhura through all of the original series' three short years and all six feature-length films, and The Bridge would not have been the same without her.
Mm-mm.
We have previously lost Spock, Leonard Bones McCoy, Scotty, and Nurse Chapel. Kirk And Chekhov and Sulu are still with us, and we'll keep our fingers crossed that they keep going for a long time. So, you know, what an incredible legacy. There was a book, I guess I read two of them. It was called The Enigma Cube and the Enigma something. There were two of them. Anyway, there was a funny little bit there where somebody, I'm trying to remember how, but it was about time travel, and somebody, a really, really very gifted physicist, was confessing to some friends like in the far future that he really liked this really cheesy science fiction series that, you know, he felt was really beneath him. And it only had three seasons, and it was called Star Trek. And he was sure that nothing was ever going to come of it, but, you know, he liked it anyway. And, of course, the joke was that, yeah, you know, it isn't – like, it's still spawning new series even today in 2023. So and also, Leo, I wanted to mention – I think we talked about it on the air last week – two series – The Dropout on Hulu and We Crashed on Apple TV. I really enjoyed them. And for those who don't know the story of Theranos, a very young female Stanford University undergrad who basically wanted to achieve Steve Jobs style success, and apparently who believed that all she needed was to want it badly enough, decided that being able to perform hundreds of blood screening tests given a single pinprick drop of blood from a user's finger would change the world. And of course, in that she was correct. You know, that certainly would have changed the world. But she was wrong in her belief that all she needed to do was wanting it badly enough. And, you know, she had, believe it or not, no education or training in the science that would be needed to realize her dream, none at all. There was never any reason to believe that it was possible, and there was a lot of reason to think that it wasn't. But those pesky details didn't give her any pause. Now, being a bit of a biohacker myself and being somewhat enthralled by this presentation, I was interested in a couple things. I wanted to know how accurate this series was, and I was interested enough in the blood testing technology that this Elizabeth Holmes and her Theranos were attempting to commercialize that I followed up by watching, you know, as much as of the various YouTube clips from the time and subsequently as I could. That is, you know, the real stuff, because everything's on YouTube now. And I even did some research in the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office to get some sense, as I said, for how accurate its portrayal of these events and characters was.
Well, it was based on a podcast, so you know it's accurate.
Because it...
The Dropout was based on a podcast.
Right.
As was We Crashed, by the way. They were both came from podcasts, oddly enough.
So for anyone else who may be interested or curious, given the available public record, everything portrayed in The Dropout was astonishingly accurate.
It was well researched,
My God. Right down to the lighting used to shine off the corneas of Elizabeth Holmes' eyes.
I noticed that, yes.
In a series of memorable close-ups.
Yes.
I even found a multi-page document which dissected the Edison mobile lab machine that they were never able to get to work. What was clear was that even if it had worked, it would never have been able to achieve what they were promising.
Yeah.
That in the series that we saw in The Dropout, the original scientists who were working on the original concept ended up, you know, leaving the company through various reasons. And their work was discarded, and basically a robot glue dispenser was used to replace this thing. And it was downhill from there. But for anyone who's interested, if you haven't seen it, I really enjoyed it. I recommend it. And We Crashed, I thought, was equally good. You know, both are – and you and I, Leo, were talking about this before the show. I think you and I particularly and other people in the industry would be drawn to this because we've seen this over and over and over, right? I mean, it is the Steve Jobs personality type that is able to bring Apple back to life from the dead. I mean, remember how close it was to being gone and to create, these things. I mean, sketchy as Elon has become, when you see those rockets come back to Earth and land, it's like,
They work.
It's astonishing. And, it takes people who have this kind of personality. I thought that We Crashed was mostly a demonstration of that personality.
Oh, I agree. Yeah.
To me, it was Newman. Less. Yeah. And well cast. Boy, guy.
Jared Leto,
he was
so good. Yeah.
Oh, just fabulous.
Very believable. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think this is both are indictments of that Silicon Valley culture where you can raise a lot of money based essentially on hype.
Yes, and charisma.
Yeah.
And the venture capitalists certainly know that for every one that succeeds big, 20 die horribly.
Right.
And burn up a lot of cash, and BMW leases are ended and blah blah blah, I mean, massive amounts of money gets burned through.
Oh yes. What
was not clear to me about We Crashed is the timeline. I think they didn't succeed in showing us that this was a 10-year span.
Right.
Because, it was crammed into 8 episodes.
Right.
So somehow I missed the sense of that time that went by, which I think would have, was sort of missing from that. I don't know how you do it. I mean, they kept flashing years up on the screen, the date, but it didn't, but they didn't convey the time that was taken. But anyway, I recommend both without hesitation, if you're interested in this idea of, fundraising personalities. It's not the way I operate. When I was creating the light pen, I built one and got it to work. And then I built like 12 and I sold them and I took the money from those and built 100 and sold them and took the money from those and, bootstrapping the old fashioned way.
Very old school. Yeah.
Which is the way Jobs and Wozniak started in the beginning with that Apple One, right?
They
got the Byte shop to agree to buy some, and who knows? They probably got a down payment from him, and then
they
used that in order to build them.
And it's a famous phone call Steve Jobs made to get the parts on credit, which no one would have given this, hippie kid, but somehow he was a good talker. He in some ways is the prototype for both Adam Newman and Elizabeth Holmes, right?
He was clearly Holmes' inspiration.
Oh,
she talked about it. She went to the black
turtleneck. Good TV too. That's I think the other side of that. It's both entertaining shows. Yeah.
Yeah. Really good and really well produced. And I will close before we talk about our show topic with an observation that Winamp has released, is about to release. Well, it's released a release candidate after 4 years in development. And I don't recall what caused me to mention Winamp last, but when I did, I remember adding something like Winamp. Really? And I was immediately scolded by a number of our listeners who said, "Hey, I'm still using it. It's the best media player ever created by man."
Yep.
And, I can certainly respect that since I've created a few things that others regard as the best ever. And they've been around for quite a while. So I just wanted to give our intrepid, diehard Winamp fans the news that after 4 years of development, the first new release candidate of Winamp has been released. Lawrence Abrams over at Bleeping Computer was where I learned of this. And basically, they've spent all of this time moving the code from Visual Studio 2008, which, by the way, is what I'm still using because it works great, to Visual Studio 2019. They now have it under 2019, so future movement will be easier. He wrote, Winamp sees development after version 5.666. Ooh, that's the wrong word. That's the wrong place to stop. Was released in 2013. And he says that was until October 2018 when Winamp 5.8 was leaked online and the developers decided to publish it themselves on the winamp.com website. And I think it was that leakage online that must have been the reason I mentioned it previously, because that seems about like 2018, about the right time frame. And he said, since then, the developers have promised an updated version with cloud streaming support and more modern features. Oh, it looks just wonderfully funky still. Lawrence has a screenshot of it, and it's so retro that it just warmed my heart, Leo. Anyway, finally in November 2021, he said, the Winamp.com website received a facelift with a new logo and a beta sign-up form to be notified when new versions were released. Last week, Winamp 5.9 RC1 build 9999 was released, marking it as the first version released in 4 years and as the first release candidate after the revitalized media player. While the Winamp release candidate does not contain too many changes, the main goal of this release was to upgrade the code base from Visual Studio 2008 to 2019. Now that this has been completed, the team can add new features and capabilities to the media player. So anyway, Winamp is not dead. It hasn't been moving a lot lately, but there's still life left in it.
Not dead yet.
Looks like there will be. It's just a flesh wound.
Just a flesh wound.
That's right.
No, I think it's really cool, and it's a great product. It has been for years. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Rowhammer's Nine Lives coming up, but first, a word from our sponsor. I have a soft spot in my heart for this company for a couple of reasons. One, they're in Ukraine. And they're still cranking out the best software, Grammarly I'm talking about, just doing a great job. The tool that everybody who writes, whether it's emails or papers or novels, should have. The other reason I love it is it's one of the best examples of what you can do in Lisp. I think there's other languages involved now in the front end and so forth, but the fundamental AI has always been done in Lisp. I love Grammarly, and I'm happy to use it. I'm a happy longtime Grammarly customer. So is Lisa. We all, communication is the most important thing. I tell my kids this, whether you're a scientist or a salesman, whatever you're doing, it's about communication and being able to write clearly, to express your ideas clearly is so important for your success, for your future, but it's also important for how you think, because it's really an important part. I'm sure you agree with me, Steve, on this. An important part of the thinking process is putting it, you could say putting pen to paper, although these days it's putting pixels to screen, but it's the same idea. Putting it down makes a big difference. Grammarly is there to make your writing fast, simple, and most importantly, clear. It's an all-in-one writing tool. It's not a spell checker. It's not a grammar checker, despite the name. It's really there to help you create clear, concise communication and do it faster and easier than ever. And that could be anything from emails to boardroom presentations to contracts. It helps you find the right words to communicate efficiently. Lisa uses it because, and this is a really perfect use for it, it also analyzes tone. Okay, so she writes a lot of emails, and she's a very busy person. She's a CEO, and like a lot of very busy CEOs, sometimes her tones can seem a little brusque because she's just writing the answer clearly. And Grammarly is great to say, well, that's you know, that's nice. Maybe would you maybe like to soften it a little bit, or gives it some her ideas to make it more friendly? And she really appreciates that. And because it's a computer program, not a human like me leaning over her shoulder saying, well, what do you mean there? It's easier to take those suggestions and incorporate them. It's a desktop app. You can actually try it right there on the website if you want. But it's a, you can use it as a plug-in, as a desktop app. It works wherever you do. Anything that you're entering text in, Grammarly can be there to help you, whether you're trying to nail a perfect cold pitch. In fact, for email, Grammarly's tone detector is absolutely free, which will help you make the right impression. Not too much, not too little, just a little bit of, you know, tone. You've got ideas in your head. Putting those ideas into words can always be a little complicated, especially as you're writing really fast. Sometimes things get a little tangled. With Grammarly Premium, you can clear up that confusion with clarity-focused sentence rewrites. Grammarly, it's kind of amazing because its AI kind of understands what you're trying to say and says, you know, if you said it this way, it might be a little clearer. It untangles those thoughts, which helps you understand better what you're trying to say, too. Grammarly Premium's tone transforms also can help you convey confidence, establish a tone, a mood. I just think Grammarly is an amazing tool. I want you to try it. You can try it right now for a free account. Go to grammarly.com/securitynow, grammarly.com/securitynow. I want to support them because I think they're making a great product and they're doing it under a lot of duress in Ukraine. So when you're ready to upgrade to Grammarly Premium, you'll get 20% off just because you're listening to Security Now. 20% off. Get to the point faster, write better, accomplish more with Grammarly, a really great tool. Absolutely. At least try it on the webpage, then maybe install the free version. Eventually, you're going to want premium. It's really worth it. And 20% off when you go to grammarly.com/securitynow. grammarly.com/securitynow. Great product from really talented coders. Yeah, they're writing Lisp. Okay, I just, you know, I like to say that.
Actually, it makes total sense that they would
AI,
be in Lisp.
Right?
It's what you, it's the right language for that.
I completely agree. Yeah. Grammarly.com/securitynow. Go ahead.
You're talking about the importance of language. And one of those sorts of conversations you have in college, you know, like, you know, along with the meaning of life.
Right.
It is, okay, we think in the language that we speak. You know, that's the way we manage our own thoughts and the way we process reality.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that the thoughts we have need to be expressible in the language we speak. So to what degree does our choice of language constrain what we're able to think?
Yes.
And as that'll, you know, that'll keep you up late at night. It's like, wait a minute. You mean I can't think anything I want? No. You can only think what you're able to express in your language.
One of the things the great Noam Chomsky, who is very important for computer science, but he was a philosopher of language. Gosh, he's 90 now, I'm seeing.
Yeah.
Wow. But great philosopher of language. And that was one of the things he was always intrigued by, is how much of the language you use, how much of what you think is informed by your choice of language. I think it's a fascinating subject.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. Rowhammer is back alive and kicking. And not only is Winamp not dead, but neither is Rowhammer.
Well, there you go.
It really shouldn't surprise any of us by now. The principle we've seen and learned over and over in context after context is that mitigating, and I've, you know, quotes, mitigating a security flaw is not the same as fixing it. And security flaws turn out to be stubborn things. All we need, you know, to do is to look at the continuing saga being brought to us by Spectre and Meltdown, you know, where the discovery of fundamentally exploitable flaws arriving from the advanced performance optimizations, which have been deeply built into modern CPUs, which can be used to leak secrets across process isolation boundaries. And we see an example of a family of flaws that similarly refuse to die. And as we know, another completely unrelated yet still fundamental flaw was discovered years ago, and we talked about it at the time, in the operation of today's dynamic random access memory. Security researchers discovered that modern memories, this is DRAM memories, you know, main memories of our systems, had become so hyper-dense with every possible margin engineered out that adjacent rows of bits, which were, of course, supposed to be completely independent of one another, were, in fact, often able to interfere with each other. And being the super clever engineers that they are, these researchers figured out how to turn the resulting spontaneous bit flips that could be induced to occur into active and effective security exploits. I mean, and just, you know, the idea of leveraging a hardware anomaly like that into a security exploit, I mean, that's just genius. Of course, the DRAM manufacturing industry responded, but not by reducing the storage density of RAM back down to where there would be sufficient noise immunity to prevent adjacent row interference. Oh, no. It responded with a, wait for it, mitigation of the problem by making the memory system still more complex by selectively refreshing the endangered rows of DRAM, which surround the rows which might be causing interference. Whether that interference was deliberate or accidental, this was named Target Row Refresh, or TRR. It's now built in to DDR4 RAM. So you know you're in trouble when DRAM is the subject of an apparently endless series of CVE-worthy exploits. There was the original Rowhammer. Then we had DRAMmer, which was the double Rowhammer. Then RAM Bleed. Then Spoiler. Then Trespass with TRR, so two R's, Trespass. And then last year's Blacksmith. It's been a never-ending parade. And now, having not yet used up its nine lives, we have the less glamorously named half-double attack. The name of this latest attack comes, get this, from a crochet stitch, which is taller than a single, but shorter than a double. I know. The point is, the actual fundamental problem of DRAM activity noise immunity being too low was never addressed. In case after case, since the cost of treating the underlying disease was too high, it would have meant backing off on DRAM storage density. Instead of treating the disease, one symptom after the next has been treated. So today, even the most recently engineered DRAM has remained diseased with some fancy patchwork added in an attempt to shore up its fundamental problem. I named today's podcast Rowhammer's Nine Lives because this problem, as I've said, refuses to die. These amazing researchers are back, having almost not surprisingly worked around the most recent iteration of Rowhammer mitigations. Their paper, which will be delivered during the same USENIX security conference next week where the TLS Anvil will be shown, is titled Half Double, Hammering from the Next Row Over. The abstract of their paper explains. They said, Rowhammer is a vulnerability in modern DRAM where repeated accesses to one row, the aggressor, give off electrical disturbance whose cumulative effect flips the bits of an adjacent row, the victim. Consequently, Rowhammer defenses presuppose the adjacency of aggressor-victim pairs, including those in low-power DDR4 and DDR4, most notably TRR. That's the target row refresh. In this paper, we present half-double, an escalation of Rowhammer to rows beyond immediate neighbors. Using half-double, we induce errors in a victim by combining many accesses to a distance 2 row with just a few to a distance 1 row. Our experiments show that the cumulative effect of these leads to a sufficient electrical disturbance in the victim row, inducing bit flips. We demonstrate the practical relevance of half-double in a proof-of-concept attack on a fully up-to-date system. We use side channels, a new technique they invented called blind hammering, a new spraying technique, and a new specter attack in our end-to-end half-double attack. On recent Chromebooks with error correction code, ECC, and TRR-protected lower-power DDR4 memory, the attack takes less than 45 minutes on average. And as I mentioned, they get root. So what these guys have figured out is sheer brilliance. They came up with a way of turning the target row refresh row hammer mitigation, which is now present in all of the latest DDR4 DRAMs, against itself. They've figured out how to use TRR to induce the problem that it's designed to prevent. Here's how they described what they accomplished. They said, Rowhammer is a widespread DRAM issue caused by the unintended coupling between its constituent rows. By repeatedly accessing one row, the aggressor, an attacker can corrupt data in adjacent rows, the victims, by accelerating their charge leakage. As a powerful means of bypassing hardware and software memory protection, Rowhammer has been used as the basis for many different attacks. Previously, Rowhammer was understood to operate at a distance of one row. An aggressor could only flip bits in its two immediate neighbors, one on each side. This makes intuitive sense. As a coupling phenomenon, the Rowhammer effect should be the strongest at closest proximity. Indeed, this assumption underpins many countermeasures which have been proposed against Rowhammer, especially the ones that rely on detecting aggressors and refreshing the charge in their intended victims. In fact, target row refresh, TRR, a productionized countermeasure widely deployed as part of low-power DDR4 or standard DDR4 chips, falls into this detect and refresh category. In this paper, we present half-double, a new escalation of Rowhammer, where we show its effect to extend beyond just the immediate neighbors. Using half-double, we're able to flip bits in the victim by combining many accesses to a far aggressor at a distance of two with just a few to a near aggressor at a distance of one. Both aggressor distances are necessary. Accessing just the far aggressor does not flip bits in the rows in the row that's two away, whereas accessing just the near aggressor devolves into a classic attack that's easily and is mitigated. Based on our experiments, Get a load of this. The near aggressor appears to act as a bridge, transporting the Rowhammer effect of the far aggressor onto the victim. Concerningly, TRR actually facilitates half-double through its mitigative refreshes, turning their recipient row into the near aggressor that co-conspires with the far one that necessitates the refresh in the first place. It's just brilliant. In effect, they wrote, the cure becomes the disease. While the discovery and evaluation of half-double is the main contribution of this work, we also demonstrate its practical relevance in a proof-of-concept exploit. However, and boy did they have to work to do this, current systems limit the attacker's control, introducing four challenges, all which they had to overcome. First, the adversary needs to allocate memory contiguous in a DRAM bank. However, without access to physical addresses and huge pages, we have to introduce a novel approach combining buddy allocator information with a DRAM timing side channel to reliably detect contiguous memory. Second challenge. ECC-protected memory can make bit flips unobservable depending on the victim data, which the attacker does not control. The adversary cannot template the memory like in previous Rowhammer attacks, since hammering requires knowledge of the cell data. As the state-of-the-art does not solve this problem, they invented and introduced a novel technique called blind hammering to induce bit flips despite the error correction ECC mechanism of LPDDR4. Third challenge to overcome, reduced address space sizes on recent ARM-based systems break the page table spraying mechanism from previous attacks. Therefore, we had to develop a new spraying technique that is still unmitigated. And fourth challenge, without templating, we need an oracle telling whether Rowhammer induced an exploitable bit flip without crashing the exploit. For this, we invent and introduce a novel approach using a specter-based oracle for exploitable bit flips. And here it is. They said, we combine all of these techniques into an end-to-end successful proof of concept, the half-double attack, which escalates an unprivileged attacker to arbitrary system memory reads and write access. In other words, full kernel privileges. The half-double attack runs within 45 minutes on a fully updated Chromebook with TRR-protected low-power DDR4 memory. And they finish. To summarize, we make the following contributions. First, we discover a new Rowhammer effect, half-double, and evaluate a set of devices and modules for susceptibility. We perform a thorough root cause analysis to empirically prove that TRR is responsible for the half-double effect. We analyze the stopgap mitigations present in today's systems and show that with a new exploit using half-double, we can bypass them and build an end-to-end attack. And our end-to-end half-double attack runs on up-to-date Chromebooks and combines the half-double effect with exploitable techniques, side channels, and a specter attack. So, the moral of our story is responding to fundamental exploitable design flaws with mere mitigations only delays the inevitable. I expect that DDR5 DRAM will learn the lessons of the half-double attack to render it, too, less effective by further complicating our DRAM. Maybe that will be the end of it, or maybe DRAM and Rowhammer will turn out to have still more life left in it.
Do you would you say maybe that you should eradicate, not mitigate? I don't know if that makes sense. It rhymes. So,
hey, Leo, great marketing term. You could raise some money with that. Eradicate, don't mitigate.
Mitigate, eradicate.
That's right.
I'm good at writing ad copy. That's my one and only skill.
That would do it. So anyway, Rowhammer's still with us, and boy, so clever to be able to use the previous hardware mitigation in order to facilitate the next generation attack.
Gumby says, Leo, leave the sloganeering to the pros. Okay, I will. Steve Gibson, you did it again, as you do every Tuesday on Security Now. Thank you so much for being here. This is, of course, the one and only show you have to listen to every week just to keep up within the fast-paced world of bad guys. Steve is at grc.com. That's the Gibson Research Corporation. There you'll find his bread and butter, his life's work, the best mass storage maintenance recovery utility in the world, SpinRite. 6.0 currently. Somebody in the Discord was saying, when is 6.1 coming out? And I told them, when it's done, not 1 minute sooner or later. So you'll find if you buy 6.0, you'll get 6.1 when it comes out as a free upgrade. You can also participate in its development. It is awfully close now. I have a feeling. I feel like. But you're right not to say it. No, don't want to. Nope.
Can't.
Nope. It's tempting, I know, but nope. If you're at grc.com, you'll note there is also a place where you can get, besides all the other great stuff, this podcast. Steve has 16 kilobit audio versions. That's unique to him. He also has the transcripts written by Elaine Ferris. Those are very, very useful if you like to read along while you listen. But also if you want to search for something, you can search the transcripts and go right to that part of the show. Also 64 kilobit audio as well. That's at grc.com. Leave feedback for Steve there at grc.com/feedback or on his Twitter. He's at SGGRC on Twitter. His DMs are open. It's worth following him to keep up on the latest. We also have a copy of the show at our website, twit.tv/SN. Audio and video available on our site, or subscribe in your favorite podcast client. You'll get it automatically the minute it's available. There's even a YouTube channel. If you hear something and say, I got to send this to the boss or to the IT department, it's the easiest way to probably send a clip is to go to the YouTube channel, and then you can just snip out that little part and send a link to them. If you are a member of Club Twit, of course, you get ad-free versions of the shows. You also get the fantastic Club Twit Discord, where the party goes on 7 days a week. You also have the Twit Plus feed. Coming up, some exciting events, August 18th, we've got Alex Lindsay's Ask Me Anything. His AMA is at 9 a.m. Pacific. On the 25th, the following week, Stacey Higginbotham, Ant Pruitt, and I will do the Stacey's Book Club, Clara and the Sun. If you haven't read it yet, you got a couple weeks. 3 weeks. Hurry up. Read it now. It's a great book. So if you want to join the club, go to twit.tv/clubtwit. And thanks in advance. It's a big help to us all. We will be back here, as we always are, next Tuesday, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC for Security Now. Thanks, Steve. Have a great week. We'll see you next time.
See you, my friend.
Hey, I'm Rod Pyle, editor-in-chief of AdAster Magazine, and each week I join with my co-host to bring you This Week in Space, the latest and greatest news from the final frontier. We talk to NASA chiefs, space scientists, engineers, educators, and artists, and sometimes we just shoot the breeze over what's hot and what's not in space books and TV. And we do it all for you, our fellow true believers. So whether you're an armchair adventurer or waiting for your turn to grab a slot in Elon's Mars rocket, join us on This Week in Space and be part of the greatest adventure of all time. Security.